This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Tony Hendra, is a great satirist who performed with John Cleese when they attended Cambridge University, went on to edit the National Lampoon and Spy magazine, and did a great send-up of John Lennon on the National Lampoon album Radio Dinners. In the heavy metal mockumentary This is Spinal Tap, Hendra played the band's manager. Hendra's new book is a memoir, and although at times it is very funny, it is also sincere and emotional in ways that we don't expect from a satirist. The book is about his long relationship with Father Joe, a Benedictine monk. They met in 1955, when Hendra was 14 and in deep trouble. The young Hendra had been having an affair with a married woman, Lila Boodle, until they were discovered by her husband, Ben Boodle. Mr. Boodle was a recent convert to Catholicism and had been giving Hendra religious instruction in the couple's home. Hendra had also helped with some chores, like clearing out the rotten lumber outside the couple's trailer. Here's a short reading from Father Joe, when Hendra is involved with Mrs. Boodle and she is trying to resist temptation. Her nickname for Hendra is Hedgehog.
Hedgehog. These impulses sometimes come over us, and we mustn't give in to them. I believe even discussing what happened could bring on the impulse again, which is why social contact between us may itself be sinful. I nodded dutifully, desperately disappointed. Being together like this is an occasion of sin, and we will have to avoid being together alone in the future until these impulses pass. You do understand, don't you, Hedgie? Now I expect you want to get started on the wood.
Then she got up and just stood there. Her eyes turned all wide and tragic, and she shook her head operatically.
Oh, my love!
She rushed round the table and cradled my head in her arms.
I can't help myself, and I don't care.
I stood up. This time I was ready. I kissed her, eyes closed, grinding away on her lips as I'd seen Victor Mature and Burt Lancaster and Stuart Granger and Errol Flynn do so effectively. She flopped her face on my chest, sobbing,
I love you, I love you, I love you. I want ordinary, corrupt human love. Go before I do something rash, something unforgivable.
I did go, in a glorious glow of love. I was in love, she was my lover. I was her lover, possibly a great lover. I had handled a love scene. Love was great, and I was in it.
That's Tony Hendra reading from his new memoir, Father Joe. Tony, how did you end up having an affair when you were 14 with this married woman?
Well, this liaison was completely unforeseen on my part. This rather odd Catholic couple had shown up at our local Catholic church, and they were rather mysterious. She was rather French in carriage and demeanor, and he was very English and much taller than Lily, his wife. I think what actually happened was that this gentleman, Ben Boodle, his name was a mathematician and a very cold fish. He was also a recent convert to Catholicism, and as we Catholics know, the converts tend to be more Catholic than the Pope. And they had as it later transpired, a very difficult marriage. I suppose this rather lonely, unhappy woman. They lived alone in a trailer down in down near the river, and this rather unhappy, lonely, trapped woman fell for an awkward adolescent, and that was me.
She seems to have almost been exhilarated by the illicit nature of your relationship. Did you find that exhilarating?
Well, I mean, I was 14 years old, and you know, I had the sort of self-identity of your average mollusk. So I was entirely delighted to have someone be in love with me, which she repeatedly said. She was very, really quite pretty, so it wasn't like you know, I was just by chance falling in love with a woman because I was 14 years old and desperate. So there was that to it too. I think her exhilaration came as much as anything because her husband was, as I say, extremely devout, so devout that he took what was known as the supererogatory path in matters of in marital matters, which meant that even though having sex for the purpose of procreation is good, the better path, the supererogatory path, is to not enjoy sex while you're having it for procreation, for procreative purposes. And so he would very carefully remove any possibility of pleasure, either for himself or his mate, by various means, but the most draconian being insisting on praying on their knees before they got down to business. So this woman was obviously looking for a way out.
Right. How did her husband find out what was going on?
Well, we did mostly kissed. But the time came when things went further, and needless to say, as always seems to happen in those situations, he walked in on us.
And what did he do?
Well, rather than beating me up or running me over with his car or something that normal husbands would do, he decided that that we should go on spiritual retreat to a monastery in the Isle of Wight, which is a small island off the south coast of England, and there meet with a scary sounding monk called Dom Joseph Warrilow, Dom being the Benedictine shortening for Dominus, or Lord, and consult with this monk to see if what he referred to as this unfortunate situation could be resolved in some spiritual way. Evidently, he and his wife Lily had consulted this monastic gentleman earlier on some other crisis in their obviously rather tumultuous marriage.
Well, you went to the monk who became known to you as Father Joe, and his reaction is a really surprising one. What did he tell you when you confessed to him what happened?
Well, Father Joe was surprising in every way. I mean, since most of my experience of discipline or retribution or punishment in the Catholic Church in the late 50s was of a physical nature or of a terrifying nature, in other words, the hell sanction. And Father Joe turned out to be a very funny-looking man. He had a sort of groundhog nose and big, flat feet like a duck, almost cartoon-looking. But he had this extraordinary stillness about him, and that he sort of folded you into. Peace sort of came off this man almost as tangibly as aftershave. And he was absolutely the opposite to anything I had ever experienced before. He was not judgmental. He listened to my story without contradiction or cross-examination. He used no words like hell or punishment or mortal sin or any of that. And at the end of my story and his consideration of what had happened, he said, "Well, Tony dear, the only real sin that you've committed is the sin of selfishness." And I realized that indeed was the sin that I had committed. The sexual aspect of it was not very important to Father Joe. It was the fact that I had done and acted selfishly on this obviously vulnerable woman. And as I grew to know him, and really throughout my very long relationship with him, which lasted almost 40 years, I realized that selfishness to him was the core failing. It was the one behind every other thing that we call sin. For Joe, selfishness was, and by this I mean not just sort of selfishness in the petty sense, but really living in a universe in which me is the center, in the me universe. And to him, that was the sin behind all sins, ancient and modern, whether it was greed or abuse of any kind or bigotry or pride,
well,
envy, anything.
Underlying that is really, I think, a very kind of profound notion of the self and the ego and a transcendence beyond that, notions that must have been pretty hard for a 14-year-old to grasp. But so what did all this mean to you, that what you had done was committed the sin of selfishness, and yet the sexual part of it didn't seem fazed by that?
No, he wasn't. And as I later learned, he, in fact, quite the contrary, did not think of sex as... And remember, this was the late 50s, so these kind of thoughts were quite, especially amongst Catholics, were quite subversive almost. He thought of sex as... I think he once said to me that he thought sex was a tremendous idea of God's, because it gave physical manifestation to the most powerful force in creation, which is love. And he even said that he thought sex was a kind of sacrament. And that was an idea which not only appealed to me on the level of not being a sanction, not being a put-down of sex, but it also appealed to me because I had never heard a priest, I'd never heard any kind of religious person, a priest or, as I sometimes call them, Catholics, people who, you know, are pious, devout people. I had never heard anyone speak like this of sex. Sex was always a sin, even thinking about it was a sin.
Oh, something that he told you that I thought was really interesting, he said, poor Lily. I mean, he felt sorry for the woman who had seduced you. What did that say to you?
Well, it was actually his initial reaction. It wasn't he had nothing to say to me before he had commented on this poor woman's predicament. And what it showed me was that that yes, I had indeed I had exploited is perhaps a rather hackneyed word, but I had, and I'm not sure I had exploited her exactly, because I wasn't awfully sure what was going on during our so-called affair. But it did show me that this woman was a real person, and I had never thought about that. To me, she was really just a wonderful, a miraculous appearance of something that would be of satisfaction to my nerve endings. But she was indeed a lonely, trapped woman and a real person. And when it really came down to it, that was what Father Joe wanted everybody to understand.
Including her husband?
Yes, indeed. Absolutely. Father Joe had no... her husband obviously was an unappetizing fellow, and in his way a very selfish fellow, but still one had to reach out to him too, as he would put it. If we live in the prison of self, you have to reach out over those walls, over your own walls and into the prison in which other selves dwell, and that's the beginning of understanding, and that is really love. It's a conscious act. It's an effort you have to make. It's not some sort of mushy, hippie feeling, you know. And that really was at the core of his thought.
So was there any punishment or any actions that were prescribed for you by Father Joe?
Any penance, you mean?
Penance, I guess that would be the word. Yes, thank
right.
you.
No, none at all, except that I was not to see her again because it wouldn't be fair to her. And that was really it. And as I say, I was not only enormously swept up by this man's stillness, by his sense of peace, but completely captivated by his approach. And it wasn't long before I wanted to become like him and enter his monastery.
My guest is Tony Hendra. His new memoir is called Father Joe. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tony Hendra, and he's best known as a satirist, but his new book is a memoir called Father Joe, and it's about a Benedictine monk who Tony Hendra formed a close relationship with over the years. The book is called Father Joe. How often would you see Father Joe and visit the monastery?
Well, I was going to school, and it was about 4 or 5 hours ride away, so it wasn't that frequent. But you know, almost every school holidays, I would get down there for at least a couple of days, and every Easter I would spend my Easter holidays at the monastery.
One Easter, you had a religious awakening at the Sunday service. You really felt bathed in the presence of God. What did that feel like?
Well, it was literally an epiphany. The main reason I had become involved with this couple that we were talking about earlier was that the man Ben had been giving me religious instruction, which Catholic children are supposed to have if they're going to a non-Catholic school, and he was a mathematician, a very brilliant mathematician from Cambridge, and he was also a philosophy major, I suppose you'd call it. And he had inculcated me with all these extremely erudite theological proofs of the various doctrinal mysteries of the Church, none of which had ever really convinced me. I mean, I understood what they meant intellectually, but they'd never meant anything to me. But after meeting Father Joe, and really, I guess, really having suddenly understood that there might be something divine in the world, that this man, it seemed to me, was on very good terms with God, this all suddenly became real to me. It all fit together. The evidence of the divine that Father Joe provided me with was the key to understanding all these intellectual exercises which had been sort of pumped into me. And it was almost as if they were all in black and white, and suddenly, in this one moment, Easter Sunday Mass in Father Joe's monastery, they all sort of burst into living color. And I became a passionate Catholic.
But a few weeks before your 16th birthday, you woke up in a panic thinking, there is no God. You were wrong. And you went to Father Joe, and you told him what had happened. And what did he tell you?
He said that the romantic part of my affair with God was over, and that it happens to us all, and that now mere feelings would be replaced by a much deeper kind of belief. And he was right. It took me quite some time to understand the force of what he was saying, because with no more feelings to support my belief, I was in despair. But he showed me that feelings are not a bad thing, but they're not something you can build on, because they do come and go. And obviously, in this case, they had disappeared very arbitrarily. The experience I'd had of losing what I thought was losing my faith and being plagued by doubts was, in fact, just a kind of just a way stage towards a deeper understanding of what I actually believed. If it's if one's belief in things is involuntary, just like a spell of good weather, then obviously it doesn't have very much depth. And as I spent more time with Joe at this particular time, I began to understand that at a much deeper level, that your faith had to be earned like anything else.
What I find really interesting about that is, here you are, you're not quite 16. You have this crisis of faith. You wake up believing you were wrong. There is no God. You're in despair. And he interprets that in such a way so that you could see this as progress, as a moving forward, because everybody goes into the stage, and now that means you're ready for a deeper faith. It's so interesting the way he handled that. It made you feel like this meant you were further along the road.
Yes. Well, one of the constant aspects of my relationship with Father Joe was that I would go wanting one thing or expecting one thing and would always come away with something far profounder and more rewarding than I had ever expected. And that sort of curve, if you like, of our meetings, our encounters, and his imparting his wisdom to me, never failed. From the earliest moments I saw him, when I expected some hooded, sinister figure to take me down in a crypt and do who knows what, and instead met this wonderfully gentle, funny, sweet, captivating man, to the very end of my relationship with him, he always had these magnificent surprises. And it was something at a much deeper level than simply having a positive attitude, you know, or being cheerful, or taking the glasses half full approach. He truly led me to an understanding that I had not had minutes before.
Tony Hendra's new memoir is called Father Joe. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with satirist Tony Hendra. His new book, Father Joe, is about the Benedictine monk who became Hendra's mentor when Hendra was 14. When Hendra was a teenager, he expected to become a monk, but then he got a scholarship to St. John's College at Cambridge University. You got a scholarship to St. John's College at Cambridge University, and you were thinking of not going because you're real desire at that point was to be a monk, and Father Joe said, no, the scholarship's a gift from God. You have to take it. You have to go. And he pushed you to go, so you did. Right. And then when you got there, you went to see the satirical review Beyond the Fringe, and you said, I went into the theater a monk. I came out a satirist. What changed you? How did seeing Beyond the Fringe affect you?
Well, perhaps I should explain what Beyond the Fringe was, because it was rather an exceptional show. Beyond the Fringe came from the Edinburgh Festival, the fringe of the Edinburgh Festival, which is the kind of the more radical part of it. Hence, it's called Beyond the Fringe, and it came out in 1960, and it was a landmark satirical review. It starred Jonathan Miller, Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, and a man called Alan Bennett, who is now a great English playwright. And the point about Beyond the Fringe was that it was the first time, really, in anyone's memory, that all the sacred goods of the English nation, what we used to call Great Britain, had been gathered in one place and mercilessly satirized. The royal family, the BBC, the Church of England, World War II, Shakespeare. It was all there in that show, and when I went to see it one night in Cambridge, I was absolutely transported by this experience, and it was I've never laughed so much before or since, I don't think, and of course I was living a monastic life, so maybe there was an element of release to it, but what most stayed with me was this extraordinary stuff called laughter. And the theater was absolutely electric with this energy, which united 500 people sitting in their seats every time another truth was revealed satirically, which is really what was going on here. And the force of this just bowled me over.
You know, in describing the show, you used the words, it was the first time that the sacred goods of England were ridiculed and mercilessly. So you're using these kind of spiritual terms to describe what happened. But I'm wondering if you were at all appalled by how the sacred goods were mercilessly ridiculed, you know?
Yes. No, I understand. Well, but that's the nature of satire. I'm sure if they hadn't been very good at it, I would have been offended. But they were very good at it. And as Lenny Bruce would say to me much later, the best laughter is the laughter that comes from laughing at stuff we're not supposed to laugh at. And that was exactly what was going on here. The very sacredness of these things was what gave them their explosive, what gave the satire its explosive force. At the time, I was not even aware, really, that I was doing anything apostate. It wasn't as if I was rebelling against anything. There was a spiritual element to this, I mean, there we were sitting in what were, in effect, fairly comfortable pews, and up on the stage or altar were four young men in black dealing with sacred matters and releasing an enormous amount of energy doing so. There wasn't a sense that this was that much different. There was something transformative about laughter in much the same way that I'd been taught that grace and prayer were transformative.
Had you been exposed to much comedy before?
Well, yes. I mean, not certainly nothing like this. But, you know, like most kids in the 50s in England, I listened to, you know, the great radio shows of that time, most notably The Goon Show, which was extraordinarily funny.
So what was your entrance into doing satire yourself?
Well, as you said, I went into the theater, a monk, and came out a satirist and believed that, you know, I would be changing the world through laughter rather than prayer for the rest of my life. And the first place I headed was a place called Footlights, which is a sort of rough equivalent of the Harvard Lampoon, I suppose, except at Footlights we do a review rather than a parody every year. And as it happened, I entered at the same time as two other young undergraduates called John Cleese and Graham Chapman. And Graham and I hit it off, and we, in fact, within a year or so, had a comedy team. It was the only time in my life when I was the straight man. But, you know, that was really how I got started, and how a lot of people got started, actually. Footlights was a hotbed of comedic talent at that point.
And then you ended up writing for the National Lampoon and performing with the Lampoon people. So, you know, and working in the United States. So all of this is happening. This is like the late 60s, the early 70s. So you're entering satire instead of the monastery. And you're doing it at a time when the counterculture is at its peak, you know. So there's like drugs and sex and, you know, no taboos. So did your behavior go from one extreme to the other?
Well, there is... there is a common syndrome, apparently, in monastic life, which is called going over the wall. And quite often when monks leave the monastery for whatever reason, they go sexually and every other way nuts. I'm not sure that's exactly what happened to me, but certainly I lost my faith quite quickly, and looking back on it, considerably quicker than I would have expected. And to that degree, I suppose I became just another modern person. Certainly, by the time I got to the Lampoon in 1970-71, you know, my attitudes were no longer monastic in any sense. They were pretty much the... You know, my values, if you like, were the values of the counterculture, whatever that means. But I never lost a sense of loss. I always had a sense that I had been privileged to experience something not better than this exactly, but very different. And I never lost touch with Father Joe through what might be called apostasy. I suppose I never lost touch with him, even though the formal aspect of his life and worldview no longer meant very much to me.
What do you think you lost your faith? I mean, you could have become a satirist and still had faith, but just not become a monk.
Yes, I think. Well, these are mysterious waters to navigate. I'm not terribly sure why I lost my faith either. I mean, there were perfectly quotidian reasons for it, which is that I discovered sex and stopped going to mass, which is a pretty good way to start. But I also think that perhaps because I had reached a rather deeper level of faith, one that depended considerably more on effort and belief. I mean, it wasn't the kind of faith, as I said earlier, that rested on feelings. Perhaps it was once I lost the impulse to make that effort, it was much easier to lose it. But to tell you the truth, I haven't really thought about that very much. The only thing I know is that I did as others did, and did the drugs and the sex and all the rest of it.
Did you feel any guilt about it?
Well, once again, I mean, the guilt I felt was not really guilt in the sense of in quite the sense that I would have thought of it earlier. There was always I always had in the back of my mind, I always worried about what Father Joe would think about this, but he would always surprise me. Once again, he never seemed to think that these things were half as bad as anyone else did, even many of the people who were doing them. And that in itself was very encouraging. And at the Lampoon, certainly, which was actually quite heavily populated with Catholics, we did a lot of Catholic material, some of it which was condemned by various organizations like the League of Catholic Decency and the Knights of Columba, so forth, St. Columba, as blasphemy. You know, that was a very interesting experience.
My guest is Tony Hendra. His new memoir is called Father Joe. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is satirist Tony Hendra, former editor of the National Lampoon and Spy magazine. His new book, Father Joe, is about the Benedictine monk who became Hendra's mentor. We did actually talk to Father Joe at one point about doing satire, and he was actually a little worried about you. What were his concerns about what writing satire might do to you?
Well, this was another of those occasions where Father Joe absolutely amazed me with this kind of reservoir of intuition that he seemed to possess. The proximate cause of this particular crisis, which I took to Father Joe as I took all my crises, was a satirical show that I'd helped create in England called Spitting Image. And Spitting Image was actually a wonderful show. The idea of it was that we had these sort of Muppet-sized puppets, which were actually caricatures of the great and near great. And we then made these puppets do outrageous things. I mean, there were people like the Royals and Maggie Thatcher and Ronald Reagan and so on. And anyway, it was a wonderful show to work on. And as it turned out, ran for 10 or 11 years in England. But I was going through a couple of major crises: the normal midlife crisis, and a wrecked marriage. And I was, and so I quit the show after the first season, and went to Core Abbey to see Father Joe, and we had this series of conversations about satire where he just exhibited this extraordinary understanding of what I did for a living. And you know, this is a man who spent almost all of his very long life in a cloister. I mean, he entered at the age of 17 and he died when he was 89. And he never saw a movie or watched a television show or had a driver's license or anything like that. But he still understood at a level even greater than mine what it was I did. And as usual, he sort of put me at my ease in a way. He would always smooth away the fear in any situation. That was the first thing he would do. And all my agonies about what I was doing, he said, "Well, you know, my dear, there is a certain similarity between the satirist and the monk. They both see something awry with the world and both set out to do something about it, which I thought was a very kind thing to say. But he was also very interested in the dynamic of satire or humor. And I remember one particular exchange we had was really caught me up short, really opened my eyes. We were talking about the, as I say, the dynamic of satire, that in order to make fun of something or somebody, you have to distance yourself from it. If it's a person, in a way, you have to dehumanize them to some degree, push them away so that they can be ridiculed. And I said that there was always this us-them dynamic to satire and perhaps to all humor. And, we're good, you're evil, we're rich, you're poor, or the other way around. We're English, you're Irish, you know, whatever. There's always this aspect to it. And he said, so that means, dear, that in order to be a satirist, you must divide the world into two kinds of people. And I said, well, yeah, you know, I mean, that's how the world works. Everyone thinks in teams. And which I think was not something that I thought of as morally, is anything but morally neutral. And we talked a little further about that. And then he got very silent and he walked on through the monastery grounds where we were having our little walk. And he stopped and he said, well, you see, dear, I think there are two kinds of people in the world. Those who divide the world into two kinds of people and those who don't. And in that one stroke, he made me realize that I had in fact become a rather inhuman person in my quest to change the world through laughter.
Wasn't he also concerned what it would do to you to mock people, to spend all your time mocking people?
Yes, well, yes, very much so. And in fact, the net result of this visit, in which I had expected him to ameliorate my crisis in some way and or alleviate it, was to actually, I left questioning at a very profound level whether, in fact, there was much point in going on with this. This was another conversation we had in which I was explaining that satire involves, at least true satire, involves taking on the sort of coloration of your enemy or your target and becoming your target and then exaggerating his or her worst aspects in order to destroy them. His only concern here was that if one did that, and in this case if I did that, on a regular basis, wouldn't I therefore become that same kind of person? Which is not something I thought of at all. I'd always thought that I could, maintain, obviously, the objectivity between me, Tony Hendra, the pure and wonderful satirist, and whoever it was I was criticizing, the execrable target. But that he didn't see it that way, and he was mostly concerned with the effect it had on me.
But that didn't make you give up satire.
No, but it certainly made me a lot more careful about my targets.
Well, but if your targets are all nice people, there's no point in targeting them.
No. I didn't mean nice people at all. I only meant the people who deserve it, really deserve
it. Oh, I see what you're saying. Right. Okay. Sure. So does religion have any place in your life now?
Oh, absolutely. I certainly... I'm a practicing Catholic. I'm not sure that the big doctrines are that I subscribe to all of them. But my wife and I are bringing our children up as Catholics. Of course, they're properly skeptical. And after Joe, died, it was very much harder for me to, I must say, for me to have a sense of the divine. I realized after he died that he really was my lifeline to that, and that that if the divine is the inconceivable, it's very hard to experience unless you know someone like Father Joe who has touched that inconceivable thing himself. And without him around, it certainly makes it much harder.
Tony Hendra, his new memoir is called Father Joe. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews The Stepford Wives. This is Fresh Air.